Hi everyone, and welcome to this episode of The Fly. We are so excited to bring you our conversation with Laura Barone Lopez, the White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour and a political analyst at CNN. We so enjoyed discussing her early experiences with journalism, covering Congress and the Biden and Trump administrations, and the importance of journalism in democracy. All this right now.
First, I want to say thank you so much for sitting down with us today. It's a great morning. We've been looking forward to this interview for a while. You know, a lot of your work, especially around 2024 elections, it's really important. And so we'd love to, you know, jump into a discussion about sort of the work you do. So can you tell us, like, what average day is like being a White House correspondent and in an analysis?
So
if there even is an average day.
Yeah, there's not really an average day. Every day is different for me, which is, and it always has been, whether I was a White House correspondent or, you know, a national political reporter or a congressional reporter. Every day is different, which is why I love, you know, why I love doing this. So right now, you know, a day for me, I work for PBS NewsHour, so we have like our 9 a.m. editorial meetings, and that's really when the show is kind of set for the day, unless there's late breaking news and then something might get changed or added to the show. But in that 9 a.m. editorial call, you know, all of us meet and each team pitches and figures out what's going to be in the show. And then I know if I'm assigned to something that day, if one of my pitches made it into the show or it didn't make it into the show, if they want it another day, because our broadcast, you know, unlike a place like CNN or NBC, MSNBC, you know, it's not 24 hours. It's a 1 hour broadcast from 6 to 7 p.m. And so there's only so much time. And despite the fact that we are only 1 hour, our segments tend to be longer. We tend to give more time to each topic, which is why I think a lot of people like coming to the NewsHour, because we don't do really short interviews. We don't, you know, do very fast 3-minute reports. We try to select what we think are the biggest stories of that day or of that week and give them the time that we think they deserve and the context that is needed, so that way viewers can really understand them. Yeah. And so if I'm on the show that day, you know, then I'm preparing basically since the end of that meeting until I either pre-tape or I'm live my report, my segment, whether I'm interviewing someone for the show or I'm, you know, emptying my notebook to the anchor about something that I cover, I'm preparing for that throughout the day, conducting other interviews, reporting throughout the day. In addition to that, you know, sometimes I'm not always at the White House every day. I'm at the White House probably multiple days a week, either to meet with sources or to go to the White House briefing, because we have a seat in the briefing room that we share with AP Radio. So we have to fill that certain amount of times a week. And then in addition to that, I may end up having to go on CNN any given day before I go on NewsHour, because I am also a CNN political analyst, as a number of my fellow reporters are with places like CNN or MSNBC or Fox. And so I, you know, depending on the news of the day, may also have to go on CNN to talk about something that President Biden is doing, the campaign trail, action in Congress, for and it could be anywhere from an hour-long hit to a 2-minute hit where I literally give one answer. And I may do that, you know, once or twice throughout the day in addition to my NewsHour coverage reporting.
And so you spoke a little bit about sort of the work you do at the White House. So not to disclose any of your journalistic practices, but sort of what type of work goes into, you know, speaking with sources and being on White House grounds? Like, do you go into the White House with sort of set goal in mind with who you want to talk to, what you want to cover, or sort of like what's like your strategy when when you're, you know, going to the White House to sort of cover these different stories?
Yeah, it just, again, it just depends on the story, it depends on what I'm covering that day. You know, if I go to the White House and I'm at the briefing, I try to prepare a few questions for the briefing, for Corrine or for John Kirby, who tend to be, you know, John Kirby's at the briefings a lot lately. But typically, you know, the White House is very different. I've covered Congress, and covering the White House is very different than covering Congress, in part because it's a lot more restricted. It's a very locked down place. You cannot just walk anywhere the way you can in the Capitol. In the Capitol, you can walk basically anywhere a lawmaker can walk, and so you can grab a lawmaker at almost any moment, sometimes alone, which is great because then you could potentially get news out of them. It doesn't work like that at the White House. You have to have set meetings. If you want to meet with any of Biden's staff, you have to, you know, you can't just walk to any part of the White House, you know, complex.
Yeah. Oh.
And so, that, you know, that sometimes makes it, that makes it a lot harder. It's not like you're just going to walk by Chief of Staff Jeff Zients the way you can walk by any staffer or any lawmaker and senator on the Hill. So, yeah, you have to, you know, a lot of times it's just keeping in touch with them via phone, via texting, asking to get regular coffees with different White House staff or administration staff. And honestly, it just depends day by day who I might be talking to because of what story I might be working on. And I am the White House correspondent for NewsHour, but because we are such a small ship, there's only I believe probably maybe less than 10 on-air correspondents. There aren't that many on-air correspondents. There's only one White House correspondent. There's only one congressional correspondent. But because of that, we get to cover a lot more than just the White House.
Yeah.
So I'm not covering the White House every day unless we really feel that there's something that the president is doing, a new action he's taking, a certain policy that we really want to dig into that we think needs to be on the show that day.
Thank you for that image into your life. And so I want to go back a little bit and ask if you can tell us the story of how you discovered your passion for journalism and how did you strive to get involved early on?
Yeah, so I've known, I'm a weird one, and I knew since I was 13, I've known since I was 13 that I wanted to be a journalist. And I figured that out when I was 13 because I was doing a History Day project, and some students may be familiar with what that competition is. It still exists. And I had competed in it quite a few times, and this was the last time I ever competed in it. But I did my project on Margaret Bourke White, a famous photojournalist who worked for Life magazine, and she covered the Great Depression, and she covered World War II, and her, you know, it's not that we didn't really have similar upbringings, but when I learned and read about her story, you know, she went from covering steel mills and, you know, taking photos of beautiful buildings like the Chrysler Building, to then realizing that it was more important to cover people and to also force and make the public confront things that they don't always want to confront. You know, make them confront the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl, and make them confront, you know, atrocities that were occurring overseas. And she was one of the first photojournalists to walk into, you know, a concentration camp. And, you know, the public doesn't always want to see images like that. They don't want to be aware of things like that. But she really felt it was her job to make people confront injustices. And I felt just a deep connection and to that, and it felt as though, oh, that could be a really rewarding career and just give me purpose in what I do. And I've always wanted to feel like, you know, there's a strong purpose to what I'm doing and a public service to what I'm doing. And so it just clicked that I would love to do that, except not as a photographer. I had no experience. But I had always loved writing, and I felt as though I was a strong writer, and I really enjoyed writing. And so I told myself, okay, I'm going to be a print, you know, journalist. And after that, I just had blinders on, and it was basically anything that I could do to get to that goal. And so I went to a Cal State in Southern California, and I knew that, you know, just graduating with a journalism degree or even a political science degree. I didn't actually get a journalism degree. I graduated with a political science bachelor's. But I knew that that wouldn't be enough, especially coming from a Cal State. It's not, you know, necessarily a well-known university. And I knew that I wanted to come to D.C. to cover government politics, you know, hold powerful people accountable. And so I just did everything I could to get professional internships while I was in college as quickly as possible. And thankfully, I had accrued enough clips from those internships. I interned at Roll Call, at Orange County Register in Southern California, at the Oregonian in Portland. And thankfully, those clips, that experience, you know, I covered politics, I did investigations, I covered solar companies' battles with Public Utility Commission in California. And so I'd also built up a number of clips covering energy and climate change. And so because of that, my first job out here in D.C. was covering energy and environmental policy.
And so, yeah, I'd love to go back to some of those early days when you interned at Orange County Register in the Oregonian. What was that experience with local journalism like? And sort of how did some of those lessons carry over to national journalism, or how, like, significantly different is the environment of local journalism compared to national journalism?
I mean, they were incredible experiences. They were my first experiences really figuring out how to structure, you know, print pieces and how to basically learn that less is more in stories. And I had two wonderful editors that I learned under there, Chris Knapp at the OC Register, who really just let me run with, you know, investigations into the California Public Utilities Commission and different solar companies there that were battling with them. And then at the Oregonian, I worked under the politics team. And again, the editor there and the other politics reporters there were just really welcoming and willing to talk about how to structure stories, how to go about covering, you know, different political campaigns, how to essentially just, you know, let me see how I want to say this. They were just really formative experiences where you know, I'm glad that I had the experience of working in local publications for the time that I did, which was about, what, almost 2 years? Yeah. And because there's something about working in a print newsroom where it's fast-paced, the editors can get a little ruthless, and, you know, they can sometimes be harsh, but I think that it's a good experience, and I think that it's good for young journalists to experience something like that. Because we have less editors now. We have less copy editors now. And we're worse for it. Yeah. So,
If those experiences shaped your today personal credo or mission in your journalism, what would you say that mission or credo is for you?
I'd say that it wasn't just like working at local papers that shaped like my mission or you know, what I consider to be my North Star.
Definitely your history day project.
Well, that, but also, I mean, it's just every experience along the way, mm-hmm. every job I've had along mm-hmm. the way. So, I mean, at my core, you know, my mission is to make sure that I am giving to the public the most accurate information as possible, and that that we're making sure that they have the truth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm trying to think. And that, you know, telling the truth, reporting the truth, is not always going to make people happy.
Yeah.
Whether it's your viewers or your readers, but also the people that you cover. And to not be intimidated mm-hmm. by that.
Yeah. And so you mentioned how you went sort of from that environment to D.C., and that's a big move going from California to D.C. to sort of cover a lot of these stories. Okay. And so do you have any piece of advice for any students that want to travel long distances to pursue, you know, opportunities?
Yeah, who want to cross the country. I guess my best piece of advice is to really get that professional experience as much as you can. So if there is a local paper, whether it's a broadcast station or a paper, that you put in your time and work for them while you're in college, because having that experience in addition to maybe whatever on-campus publication or, you know, radio station that you might work for, I think is incredibly important, because that's what news organizations are going to look for. Did you get any professional experience while you were in college? And then, of course, you know, networking is important, and it's not always fun, but it is, and sometimes just randomly calling up editors or reporters and telling, if it's a reporter and editor whose work that you admire, whose work that you would like to, someone you'd like to work for one day, sometimes just sending them an email or asking them for a coffee or asking them for a phone call is all that it really takes. And then you get on their radar, and, you know, everyone loves to talk about what they do. They love to talk about their jobs, and that can really be helpful as well.
Yeah.
Awesome. And what challenges and successes have you faced as a woman of color in this industry that's white and male dominated?
Yeah. Sometimes it can become, I guess when talking about challenges, or just the experience, you know, when I was a Capitol Hill reporter, I was often the only woman of color in scrums. Those are when, you know, you're in like little groups of reporters huddling around a lawmaker as they're walking down the hallway. Like, I would often be the only reporter of color in those scrums. And sometimes that can just weigh on you and feel exhausting when you look around and you're one of the only people that looks like that.
Yeah.
It's gotten better on the Hill, and it's gotten better in newsrooms in my, 10 years since I've been in D.C. But oftentimes at publications I've worked at, I've been the only woman of color in a senior position, in a senior reporting position. Or I've been the only woman sometimes. So, you know, there have been times where editors will come to you and ask you almost to speak for every person of color,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
which is clearly not appropriate,
yeah.
But that has happened to me. there was one time where I was the most senior Latino reporter in the newsroom, and then one of the other most senior reporters of color who is Black, we were asked to have a meeting with the top editors to explain Black Lives Matter. It was a surreal experience. And one that I, you know, we took it head on and we did our job and we didn't complain about it. But afterwards, we both were a bit frustrated. And of course, all of those senior editors were white and they were male. But I will say that I think that that colleague and I really made sure that that publication had strong coverage on the Black Lives Matter movement, on the protest after George Floyd's killing, and made sure that that publication wasn't making mistakes that I think publications have in the past.
Yeah.
So, and it the to the rewarding and successes part that you asked about, you know, sometimes reporters of color or young people who want to be a reporter who are also a person of color will come to me and ask me, do you feel like you can be yourself in these newsrooms? Do you feel like, you know, you have to change who you are? No, I don't. Am I an advocate? No, I'm not an advocate. That's a decision I made a long time ago, that I was not going to be a partisan or an advocate.
Yeah.
But I do have a different lived experience than a lot of other people in the newsroom, than who are senior, the majority of who our senior editors are, the experience they've had. And I can talk about that.
Yeah.
And I can bring that into meetings, and I can change the way we cover things and make sure that we're covering, you know, Latino and Black voters just as much as we're covering, you know, white voters in diners. And so I think I've been successful in doing that in the different newsrooms that I've been in, in forcing the editors to confront blind spots that they have. And, you know, at a place like Politico, I was able to do that during the 2020 campaign cycle, making sure that we had just as much coverage of Black and brown voters as we did of white voters, making sure that during the COVID pandemic, you know, one piece I was really proud of was when we were the first to really report the disproportionate impact on Latino essential workers.
Mm-hmm.
New York Times then followed suit after we wrote that. So just making sure that stories were covered in a fair, accurate way about people that don't always get the same amount of coverage.
Yeah, and so speaking, this is sort of shifting slightly, but speaking a little bit more on the topic of fair coverage, I think we're like in a pretty unique time in history for our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Our democracy is being tested. It's being tested very strongly. And so how do you feel about news outlets? Do you believe that news outlets are sort of playing a normalizing role in the anti-democracy sentiment because of the fear of appearing partisan? Sort of how do you overcome this fear of partisanship when one party's major candidate sought to overturn the election and the other party major candidate is sort of running completely on the pro-democracy route. So how do you overcome sort of that partisan divide that you see in typical election cycles, or that partisan, like bipartisan coverage that you see in typical election cycles, by sort of reporting now that one candidate stands for democracy and the other doesn't?
So I guess there's two questions in there, right? Are you asking me, do I think that the press is normalizing Trump, and then what was the second question?
Sort of how do you overcome, you know, the fear of appearing partisan?
Oh.
I think it's a little bit of a leading question, and maybe a basis of it is Trump meaningfully different as a candidate than other people, than other candidates? Could be another way to look at it.
So there are some reporters who I think are doing a good job of not normalizing the moment that we're in and not normalizing candidate Donald Trump. And then there are other reporters who I think still believe or want to believe are that we still live in the world that we lived in more than 10 years ago, and we don't. So, yes, I'm a pro-democracy journalist, and I think every journalist has to be pro-democracy if you're going to have a free and fair press. And Donald Trump is an anti-small-d democracy candidate, and I'm not the only journalist that has stated that fact. There are a lot that are willing to state that fact. You know, you saw the battle after 2016 and after he was first president over whether or not to say that Trump said something was a lie. It took a lot of news organizations, a lot of outlets, a long time. You know, some were ready to say it pretty fast. Others took a very long time to say that something that came out of his mouth was a lie. When he very clearly is lying about the 2020 election being stolen. He very clearly is lying about when he says 2024 is going to be rigged if I lose, which he has said. You know, and those are just two of the many lies. But I think that, I guess going back to when I was talking about sometimes the public doesn't always want to confront things because it makes them feel uncomfortable. You know, the press can react to things that way too. And you know, when Trump threatens violence or implies to his supporters that he would like to see them take up arms, he does things like that so often that sometimes there's conversations in newsrooms like, oh, do we need to cover this again? Because he, you know, he says this all the time. That is how something becomes normalized. I've been in meetings where other reporters have said, like, well, do we need to cover this again? Even though his rhetoric has become more extreme, you know, over the years of him being in the political public space, because clearly he was in the public space before. But, and I think that that can be really harmful. And so, yeah, there's, I think, a lot of reporters across different newsrooms are constantly battling about how exactly to cover him. But I think that when the leading candidate for one of the two major political parties is out there lying about our election system, out there saying that the Constitution should be suspended so he can regain power, when he's out there saying that if he's not reelected, then 2024 will be the last election that we have, that it's incumbent upon reporters to cover that, to call that out, to provide correct context about where we've seen that before, to also talk about the impact that his words have, because we've seen the impact, which is that there have been death threats hurled at judges, at jurists, at prosecutors, at election officials, exactly. We have seen the impact, and it's our job to make sure that the public is confronted with that, whether they want to be or not.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And so let's switch a little bit to now President Biden and his White House, and then, of course, Congress. So you covered this relationship. During that time, were there any significant bipartisan achievements that you want to discuss? How did Biden get it done, especially compared to President Trump? And what do you learn about bipartisanship in such a divisive, polarized time?
I'm sorry. I wanted to add something.
please,
to what we were talking about. And I'm trying to figure out how I want to say it. I think another important... I think something else that reporters have to cover a lot this election cycle... isn't just Donald Trump and his lies, but also the entire, all of his allies and all of his enablers. Yeah. So, and that he isn't acting in this alone, that there are a lot of people, House lawmakers, senators, local lawmakers, who have gone along with the lies, who have gone along with his efforts to overturn an election cycle, who just dismiss when he, you know, threatens violence, or dismiss when he calls, you know, says that migrants are poisoning the blood of the country. And so I think it's incredibly important for reporters to hold those people accountable just as much as we do Donald Trump. And that's incredibly important in this moment right now.
And so before we hop into the lightning round, to go back to current President Biden, you've covered him since 2020. So, like, what are some of the significant differences you've seen between the Joe Biden of 2021 to the Joe Biden of 2024?
And maybe adding to that, the Trump of 2020 and the Trump of 2024.
Yeah. Sorry, did I skip over your question?
It's okay. Let's move on.
Okay. Sorry.
No.
So how Biden has changed since 2020?
Yeah.
Well, President Biden, you know, during during that Democratic primary, President Biden was pretty much pushed to the left on a number of issues, including, you know, descheduling marijuana, including student loan forgiveness, including immigration, and a variety of other policy issues, because there was such... there was a big pull from the progressives. You know, he established this unity committee with Bernie Sanders and his surrogates to really show that he was going to pay attention to the progressive wing of the party. And I think they'll tell you that he did, you know, especially after during the first 2 years. And his chief of staff at the time, Ron Klain, had like an open door policy with progressives, would let them talk to him all the time. Bernie Sanders, like, would constantly be talking to Ron Klain. But what you've seen shift in the last year or so, due to some pressure from the right, is President Biden's immigration policies have significantly changed based on what he ran on. He ran on saying that he would, you know, undo Title 42, which was the deportation era policy started under Trump in response to the pandemic that allowed immigration officers to just deport migrants immediately if they were encountered without giving them the right to asylum, which, by the way, migrants have a right to asylum whether they present at a port of entry or between a port of entry. Between a port of entry is what is, you know, called an illegal entry, but they still have that right no matter where they present themselves. And now you've seen President Biden be willing to sign into law one of the most conservative immigration bills that we've seen in decades. He didn't ask for a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers. He essentially was ready to give Republicans everything they wanted. So that's one big area where he's changed. Where, you know, Democrats and immigration... advocates really feel, some Democrats and a number of immigration advocates really feel kind of betrayed by him on the immigration front.
Do you think that's because immigration is voters, the polls are showing now, number one issue that he's changed? Do you think it's in response to public opinion, or is it more to a political move?
Well, that's the same thing, right?
For his colleagues in Congress, the Republican... caucus in Congress.
Yeah, it's response clearly to the politics.
Okay.
So the pressure applied by Republicans, you know, who incorrectly are saying that there's a migrant crime wave. There's no evidence or data to suggest that there's a migrant crime wave. But voters have a voters are saying that immigration is one of their top issues. And so because of that, you know, President Biden is reevaluating his immigration positions. Mm-hmm. You know, President Biden also has always, though, long been in favor of giving more money and more resources to law enforcement. That goes back decades. Mm-hmm. And so some of this is, you know, purely, it's some of this is also just who Biden is and where he feels comfortable on these positions.
Yeah.
So, you know, he actually gave more money to local law enforcement, to local police after he was elected. He wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that. But I would say that immigration is probably one of the more recent policy shifts. But you've also seen, on the other side, the president talk much more about abortion than he ever has his entire career, you know. And it's an issue that he and his vice president, Kamala Harris, are going to make a really prominent prominent argument on this cycle, because it motivates voters. They think it'll help turn out the Democratic base, but could also potentially sway some persuadable voters to his side.
Yeah, and thank you so much. Looks like we're knocking around on time.
Yeah.
It talks so much more, especially about the humanity of a lot of these issues.
Yeah.
I think so often we get caught in the politics and lose sight of sort of a lot of the people behind these issues, and we can see how that impacts rhetoric. And so I'd love to hop into a quick lightning round.
Okay.
A few quick questions. First one, this is the tough one. East Coast or West Coast?
Oh my god. You really are going to get me in trouble.
You have one East Coast and one West Coast person in this room. So.
I mean, I'm from the West Coast, but I now own a house on the East Coast. East Coast.
Okay.
Okay.
My family is gonna be mad.
You won't send them this episode.
What's your favorite place to eat in DC?
Oh, that's hard. My favorite place to eat. Well, I was just talking with some other students about this. It's really hard to find good Mexican food in DC,
mm-hmm.
and I'm Mexican American, and I'm a snob about Mexican food because of my grandmother's, my nana's cooking, but also just Southern California has better Mexican food. But Taqueria Xochitl has really great tacos, so I would recommend them. If I want a slightly nicer dinner, Queen's English is great. I really love that. It's inspired by like Hong Kong street food. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, next one would be, would you covering Congress or covering the White House?
Oh my God. You guys are going to get me in trouble. Congress.
Okay. Congress. And who's the most famous person you have in your phone? Or most notable political figure.
Yeah, I was like, I don't have famous people on my phone. If you want to consider... I'm trying to think about who I want to say. I don't know. I have a number of senators on my phone, which are probably the most famous.
Okay.
Well...
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
We really enjoyed speaking with you, and we appreciate your time at Georgetown, and good luck in all of in upcoming 2024.
Yeah,
and we hope those questions don't get you in trouble.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to The Fly. You can find us on social media at The Fly Georgetown. If you enjoyed our conversation, make sure to subscribe to The Fly and leave a 5-star rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or SoundCloud. Our researchers are Kenneth Jackson, Julian Zeitlinger, Abigail Asadi, and Chase Dobson. Our communications team is Andrea Smith, Austin Culpepper, Darius Wagner, and Sarah Sverdlov. Our production team is Will Hayes and David Grice. Original theme music is composed by Ada Eng and Bella Carlucci. And I'm Fiona Gallagher, Managing Director of the Pod. The Fly is brought to you by the Georgetown University Institute of Politics and Public Service, and is made possible by the McCourt School of Public Policy. Thanks so much for listening, and fly with you soon.